In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 301. Who is the real Hillary Clinton? She is the military-industrial candidate, says our guest today, Kelly Vlahos. Kelly has spent the last 14 years as a reporter and columnist in Washington, D.C. She is currently a contributing editor for the American Conservative magazine and a longtime political writer at FoxNews.com. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
How can I not talk to you about an article called The Military-Industrial Candidate? Was that your title or Dan McCarthy's?
You know, I think it was a collaboration there. I believe I mentioned it in the column, but I think that that was an overarching theme of the story itself. I'm going to give credit to one of my sources. I think it was Mike Lofgren, who I do quote in the story. Mike had been an aide on the Hill in the Budget Committee, specifically on national security issues, for 30 years. He's seen everything. And one of the first things he said about Hillary Clinton when I interviewed him about this was that she is the military-industrial candidate, that she is the military-industrial complex's candidate, meaning that she will go to bat for them, specifically on budgets and war issues. So I think that that sort of became a thread throughout the article.
We'll get into the specifics in a minute, but I'm amazed at the degree to which the Fox News wing of the electorate is so unaware of Hillary's real identity. She is in no way a pinko lefty peacenik in that sense of lefty.
Well, what's interesting, and I have to disclose, I do work for Fox News. I am a writer for them. So, I mean, which is, I think, good, and it helps inform my writing, because I am aware of how the different political interests are viewing candidates, storylines, narratives, what have you. That said, when dealing with Hillary Clinton on the air, many of these right-wing or conservative media outlets like Fox have been gentle on Hillary because she has been a hawk on the Hill dating back to her Senate days after 9/11. When she's not running for office, they are more gentle on her because she often votes the way that they would like on these national security issues. When she does start making moves, or when the storyline is about her potential presidential run, then they start calling her a liberal and a pinko or whatever, but what have you. So you do see that that split there on how Hillary is treated. I think inherently they know that Hillary is not has never been a dove on these issues. She may talk a good game, and that's where I personally get confused about how I look at Hillary. Is she a liberal trapped in a hawk's clothing? Or is she a hawk trapped in a liberal's clothing? She's been so great at sort of confusing, or at least presenting herself as two different people most times, that I think that you see that in the coverage of her. Because people don't know whether to treat her as a hawk or a dove, and I think that's to her great advantage. And she is, above all, a politician. And she's been able to craft a persona in which she is seen as a sort of mother goddess figure, where she goes off into the world and she wants to help women, and she wants to forward human rights in different countries and democracy. But at the same time, she has advocated war time and again to forward those goals, to achieve them. So it's fabulous, because she does appeal to both sides. She appeals to the liberals because she's out there talking about women's rights, and then she appeals to the hawks to a certain extent, because she has voted for war. She has advocated for war since her husband's days in office.
It makes me think she has no principles whatsoever. I can deal with people whose principles are the exact opposite of my own. At least I know where I stand.
Yeah.
But given her whole career and given her obvious lusting after power, it seems to me that she's kind of like John McCain, in the sense that I remember McCain saying something along the lines of, and I'm going to clean it up a little bit, but if they want their stupid fence on the Mexican border, I'll give them their stupid fence. You know, like whatever these stupid rubes want, I'll hand it to them if that's what it takes for me to get in.
You know what? I might have to disagree with you there.
Oh, good. All right. No, I'd love to hear it. All right. Tell me.
Well, personally, I think that she has principles. It's just that I think that many of us and many of people in your audience would be fearful of those principles. When I cite in my piece, she had done a review in the Washington Post of Henry Kissinger's recent autobiography. She talked incessantly about global world order and how the United States is, and this is very messianic in a way, where it is sort of the beacon that's going to go out and help bring democracy to these countries. It is our responsibility as a nation, as a democratic nation, to go out and help these other countries see the light. I'm oversimplifying here, but she really does have that vision that we are a global capital G leader. And what I'm concerned with, and I think your audience would be concerned, is how does she get to that point? Well, for Hillary Clinton, she gets to that point in many examples through war and intervention. And I think that if there's any consistency in Hillary Clinton's career, it is her belief that we have this mission, this global mission, and that in many cases she has advocated military intervention to see that goal through. So I do think she has principles. It's just those are the very principles that I think you and I are nervous about.
But yet when she says, at a time when it requires the expenditure of no political capital at all to say so, that in retrospect, if I had known then what I know now, I would not have supported the war in Iraq. Can we take that seriously, though?
Yeah, no, I agree. I do agree with you there. And that is a fantastic example. And many politicians of her ilk have done the same thing in the wake of the Iraq war, where they say, including Henry Kissinger. And if I had been able to write more and had more space in my article, I had to, I had to edit it as we all do. But, I make a note that Henry Kissinger, who is this lionized figure of national security wisdom and has been since the Vietnam War, which is confusing in itself, that someone who was integral in one of the most failed, disastrous foreign policy and national security events of our recent memory is lionized in such a way. But even he said, if I knew now, or if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have supported Iraq. And of course, Hillary agrees with him. And it makes you wonder, well, if these guys have, and this gal has such wisdom and such experience and such bona fides for military strategy and foreign policy, how could they have gotten that wrong? Well, we know better. We were all lined up with the hawks to intervene in Iraq for political interests, just like Hillary's husband was the first one to declare, a regime change, a policy for regime change against Saddam Hussein. But we know why she did it. And then, obviously, and you're right, when it was politically expedient to disavow that position during the 2008 election, in which he lost against Barack Obama. Yes, she did say, oh, I made a mistake. So you're right. There has been some flip-flopping there on political expediency, but I still think it's the hawk position is her true position, and it is, and it stands on some sort of principle. I just don't agree with it.
Now, looking through her tenure as Secretary of State, we see ample support for your thesis in the article. Give us the Reader's Digest two-minute overview of Hillary Clinton faced with foreign policy crises and how she deals with them.
Well, I mean, I think that Hillary Clinton, and I think that that warrants a separate article. I think her tenure as Secretary of State is more emblematic of ineffectual, an ineffectual term, more so than a hawkish term. I think on the hawk side, she supported all of Obama's policies, and Obama's policies were bombing Libya, getting an intervention there. What's going on with ISIS today? All of the sort of scattered counterinsurgency, counterterrorism operations through North Africa, expanding the footprint there. And of course, Afghanistan. She supported the policies of the surge in Afghanistan. So I think personally, I don't think she was an effective Secretary of State, not because that she was too bold, too interventionist, too hawkish. I think she was more cautious, and she seemed more concerned with traveling the world and maybe tamping down little things and then fixing the bureaucracy at Foggy Bottom here in Washington. I just don't think that she was effective in making any real changes or improvements or reforms in our foreign policy overseas. That said, I think, where was I going with this? What I was thinking in terms of where she actually stepped outside of that, that norm was when she had advocated on the inside for bombing Syria last summer. She had joined forces with then CIA Director David Petraeus and then Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta in encouraging intervention in Syria. And then she came out last summer and complained that Obama hadn't listened to her and that had created the problem with ISIS today, the crisis in Iraq and Syria today with the growth of ISIS. So somehow, if there had been a military intervention in Syria, we would not have ISIS today and everything, we wouldn't have war in Syria. So that is where she has sort of made her break with the administration, but it wasn't until after she left that, a lot of this had come out, and Leon Panetta came out and said that he would have left the residual force in Iraq, yada, yada, yada.
Let's talk about that, because Panetta had been on board supporting Obama's policies all this time, including drawing down in Iraq, and then all of a sudden saying, well, maybe, it was a mistake that the president made, we should have kept troops there. What does that change of heart maybe have to do with a firm called Beacon Strategies?
Right. Well, Beacon Strategies is a consulting firm that was started by some expatriates of the Clinton administration, Clinton campaign, Clinton, staff over the years, and which Leon Panetta is now a member of. He is a consultant for Beacon Strategies. They are supposedly have sort of been formed to advise companies on foreign policy, foreign governments on foreign policy and national security, but have been, more or less considered a sort of Clinton cabinet in waiting, at least on the foreign policy front, national security front. So that aside, my thesis, which is not original, is that we have heard a lot from Leon Panetta in recent months. He has a new book out, and which in part he criticizes the president for, A, not leaving a residual force in Iraq, something he had not. He had actually advocated full withdrawal at the time when he was defense secretary. Now he's saying that the president messed up, and again, that is why we're seeing all of this war and strife in Iraq today. He also complained that the president didn't act in Syria when Mrs. Clinton and David Petraeus had advocated along with himself a year ago. So my theme, my thesis, is that what we're seeing is one old Clinton time friend helping another. And he perceives her as potential Democratic candidate for president, maybe even the first woman president. And Panetta, being an old friend of the Clintons, is, you know, basically positioning himself, helping her out in the media. Immediately when he had gone out and started criticizing the president, first on 60 Minutes and then another media outlets, you know, conservative commentators, including Karl Rove, had called him a patriot, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
And Fox News, too, had, you know, had reacted to Panetta's revelations in a very positive manner. So I think ultimately that helps Hillary Clinton because, you know, she's able to, A, distance herself from the president from who she worked for, but also position herself as more hawkish than Obama. And I think she ultimately needs to do that if she is going to be a strong presidential candidate in 2016. I mean, for as much as you and I would like to see someone who has more more of a Rand Paul type, I'm not saying that I'm a supporter of Rand Paul, but just in terms of foreign policy, more cautious, non-interventionist policy, you know, we'd love that, right? But on the poll after poll has shown that somebody that shows tough, strong national security bona fides on the in the presidential campaigns usually it has the advantage. Maybe not every year. I think probably you and I would agree that Obama had beaten her in part in 2008 because there was such a backlash at the time against the Iraq war. And he, in good timing, you know,
right.
helped him out. But, you know, typically when I talk to people who are smarter than me on this issue, on political issues, is that, you know, for as much as we hate it, the person that shows, like, the backbone that looks strong, the person that's going to pick up the red phone at midnight and respond to a crisis is the one that has the electoral advantage.
And I definitely get that. I think that's in large part, well, it's partly because the public has been conditioned to think this way, but
right.
and because nationalism is such a poisonous force and all that, but also because we haven't seen a really articulate response to these people. Like somebody like Mitt Romney standing on stage repeating platitudes should be, rhetorically anyway, smashed into the floor by somebody saying, look, every single thing you've called for has obviously made things worse. Like if you Mitt Romney, if you were trying to spread radical Islam, how could you do a better job than we've done already? I mean, somebody getting up there and Romney's not prepared to answer any of that could actually change things. But I'm afraid that right now all we've got are mealy-mouthed people who are afraid of saying the wrong thing and want to be like 20% less Romney than Romney. Then Romney's going to win. Like I mean, Romney's going to win. He'll run again and he'll beat anybody who's too scared to stray from the plantation on these issues.
Right. And then if you'll recall the last, you know, that the last nomination process in 2012 where all the Republicans were lined up, we take, you know, obviously take Ron Paul out of this equation. But, I mean, they had to outdo each other on how hawkish they would be to the point where they were outright advocating bombing North Korea, I think, at one point. And so by the time you get through that process, Hillary Clinton, anything she says will look more measured, you know, more articulate, more intellectual than anything those guys are saying.
Right.
Even though what she's really advocating is just the status quo when it comes to military and foreign policy issues.
I talked to Bruce Fein once, and he said that the one thing that would make running for president fun would be being in the debates with foreign policy knowledge and wiping the floor with everybody else. I mean, that's what I want to see someday. That would be nice to see. Now, I don't think I'm going to see it in the Democratic Party. And the reason is that I think Nixon was right in the early 70s. He knew that the reason that there were all these anti-war protests was because of the draft. If I get rid of the draft, for all these people who say I'm out on the streets for the principled reason that it's wrong to kill all these foreigners, they really just wanted to save their own rear ends. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. No way am I opposed to people who want to save their own rear ends, but I am opposed to people who claim that they're standing for principle, but then when their own comfort is assured, they disappear. Likewise, since that decision to take the draft off the table, anti-war has not been as big of an issue as it used to be. And I wonder, are there Democrats, are there enough Democrats who care about peace who won't jump onto the Hillary bandwagon? I'm not talking about the people at Counterpunch. There are 12 of those. How many among the Democratic Party? Are there enough to be an obstacle to Hillary?
Well, and I don't know if you've talked about this lately on your show, but there were some, Jim Webb, a conservative Democrat out of Virginia, has launched an exploratory committee for president. I did a story on this for FoxNews.com, and I talked to veterans and I talked to conservatives because, you know, they're my friends. And so I had to pull this together, and I kind of knew where I wanted to go with this because, you know, we all know that, you know, Democrats will vote for Democrats, but I wanted to know about conservatives voting for independent conservatives voting for Jim Webb. And to a person, they said, you know, we don't know if he has a shot, but I'll vote for that guy because I don't want to see Hillary getting the nomination, because they feel that he's got the bona fides. He's a Marine. He worked under the Reagan administration as Secretary of the Navy, and he has been vocal about non-interventionist issues. He voted against the Iraq War. You know, he refused to get in line to be seen with the president when he first was elected senator. You know, his son was fighting in Iraq. I don't know if you remember this story, but all the freshmen were getting in line to get their picture taken with Bush, and he wouldn't get in line.
Yeah, I remember that.
And Bush noticed, and he came over, and he's like, "Hey, Jim, how's your son?" He goes, "I'd rather not talk to you. That's my business." And he goes, "When are you going to get our boys out of Iraq?" And Bush said, "That's not what I asked you. I asked you how your son was." And I forget the exact response to that, but it wasn't nice.
But see, that to me shows somebody. I don't want to get caught up with politicians and enthusiasm for politicians, but normally you just completely fold and melt in the presence of the president. And somebody who refuses to do that and refuses to get starstruck does get my attention. I'll at least put it that way.
And what also gets my attention, and I think gets a lot of independent conservative attention and veterans, is that he was able to prove that you can be pro-veteran without being pro-war, and you can do it in a way that's really smart and effective and actually productive. And when he was elected to the Senate, he had pushed... was the author, and he pushed for reforms to the GI Bill. Now, there's a lot of flaws to that GI Bill, you know, probably unforeseen, but that could be another show. But the point was that his first order of business was going to bat for the veterans. And then his second order of business, and this had hardly been covered by the media because it wasn't sexy enough, but he had headed a commission for wartime contracting with Claire McCaskill, in which they had poured through all of the contracts that we had overseas, all the private contractors, what they were doing, how much money was being lost, billions of dollars being lost. It's all there in black and white. And he spent many hearings going through this because they wanted to get their hands and hearts and minds around, like, all this money that we spent over there that's been lost. And they came up with some good stuff. Unfortunately, the media didn't cover it. So we'll probably make the same mistakes again in the next war. But the fact that that's what he, concentrated, and also on prison reform. So I think that he actually did some good work. But bottom line is, he's not some mealy-mouthed or squishy liberal who just basically hates the military, hates veterans, anything to do with war. He actually has a really good argument against intervention, but he's very pro-military. He knows that we need a strong defense, to defend the country, you know, abiding by the constitutional responsibilities to defend the country, but getting into all these, you know, endless wars to solve problems. Every problem that we have overseas needs to be settled, you know, with boots on the ground and guns and bombs and drones. He doesn't abide by that. I think that is appealing to people who might be Democratic, maybe a Democrat, and can't stand the idea of electing Hillary because she is a hawk.
Right. Well, that, yeah, the Jim Webb story is definitely an interesting one, and I'm glad you raised it. Before I let you go, Kelly, I want to ask you, as somebody who's spent a lot of time, I mean, years and years you've been writing as a journalist, and I want to know, especially these days when you're a freelancer, I mean, you have a connection with the American Conservative magazine, as I do, and you mentioned FoxNews.com. What have you found to be the pros and cons of the growth of the internet for the freelance writer?
Well, I think, you know, that I'll start off with the cons. I mean, the growth of the internet in concert with the collapse of the economy in 2008 just obliterated the freelance market. In terms of, you know, the money that I would make for a story per story has gone down exponentially. It's not something I could do and raise a family on, let's put it that way. I think you have your upper echelon of freelance writers who might be writing for Vanity Fair or your top glossy magazine, and there's a really small like percentage of those who probably can eke out a living, you know, because they demand a high price per story. But the vast majority of freelance writers don't make much money. The market has just hit bottom in terms of what websites are paying for content, for original content. What I've found is that original content is not valued the way it was, say, 10 years ago. So people regurgitate content that they find on the internet. They use aggregators. They have kids right out of college who, not putting them down, but with very little experience in the business, just basically cobbling together stories and slapping a byline on it, or not even a byline on it, for employers. I found that, you know, the quantity is valued over quality. So you have a lot of websites now that are just hiring people to basically just rewrite copy, as opposed to going out and finding freelancers to write for them, and then paying them a decent wage for that. Of course, the positive is that we have so much access to information now that we didn't have. As a freelancer, as a reporter, I mean, obviously, it's so much easier to access documents and files and data, whereas when I first started out in the business over 20 years ago, you'd have to actually go to City Hall, you'd have to get things faxed, you have to do a lot more, like, on-the-street gumshoeing, which I kind of miss those days a little bit, but on the most part, the access, and, you know, I'm able to promote my stories, you know, on such a wide basis now through Twitter, for example. I use that my chief way of getting my stories out on Twitter. And, you know, back in the day, even 10 years ago, you know, a story would come out, and sometimes I'd feel like it was going into a black hole, especially if it was going to a small, tiny niche audience. So I think that there's definitely pros and cons.
Well, I've got your website up on the show notes page. Show notes page for this episode number 301, is tomwoods.com/301. Your website is kellyvlahos.com. That's Kelly with an E-Y and then V-L-A-H-O-S. And then I'll put up your Twitter link also, but tell us what your Twitter name or handle or whatever the thing is. What is it?
Well, it's Kelly B. Vlahos, so it's K-E-L-L-E-Y B. Vlahos, or just at Kelly B. Vlahos. That's my Twitter handle. So I don't know if you're on Twitter very much, but I find that I try to keep up, and I mostly use it actually to keep an eye on what other people are writing too. I think it's a great tool, not just to spout off your point of view all the time, but also to see what other people are writing about as a journalist. It's kind of been really neat for me.
Yeah, see, I think I just hit 30,000 Twitter followers, which is not.
Oh, you're way ahead of me.
Well, my Twitter followers are always like slightly less than half of my Facebook followers, and yet on Facebook I get like 20 times the interaction, and so I still use Twitter because there are people I'll never reach on Facebook via Twitter. And how much effort does it take to put out 140 characters? But I haven't quite mastered it, really. But you're right. Dan McCarthy of the American Conservative says the same thing about Twitter, that he uses it primarily to, as a news aggregator, really, to see what other people have identified as interesting articles, and then he follows up on
right.
that. My problem is I follow so many people, I haven't taken the trouble, I haven't had the time, really, to sit down and make a separate list of the people whose content I really, really value and I want to look at for story ideas and stuff, and I really should do that. I suppose you've probably done that.
You know what? I'm with you. I've kind of never moved away from the main like timeline. Like I've done a couple lists. Like when I was working on election night, I did make up a list of all the prominent election people, you know, writing about the election, because I really needed to kind of keep, you know, on real time with what was going on. But I haven't got as savvy as some folks who have different lists going on. And you know, so I'm not an expert on that, but I do find that, and you probably do too, that, you know, 10 years ago, I keep saying 10 years ago, but several years ago, blogs were the big thing. So you would go to different blogs every day to check on what people were saying, and they would link to different stories about that everybody was talking about.
Right.
And it's Twitter. So I go to Twitter every day, and then I go linking off to wherever. I don't go to the blogs first. I think that that's an interesting...
That is an interesting development. Well, it sounds like you and I have the same situation where we each have a long list of things that if we had three spare lifetimes, we would eventually get to. Like, we know would be valuable, but I just can't do it now. Well, Kelly, I'm really pleased to talk to you today. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you ask me, this was just an absolutely fantastic conversation. So, I mean, just keep me in mind when you have a, especially if you have a story that you feel like is unjustly being buried and doggone it, it's got to get out there. I want you to make sure and drop me a line.
Oh, I will. I appreciate it. And I plan to stay on Hillary like glue for this election, because I really think that there has to be another voice out there, not necessarily, you know, the shrill right-wing voice that says that, you know, anything she does is wrong and she's a witch, but the voice of, like, you know, the independents that often you don't hear saying, wait a minute, you know, and I plan on being that. I don't want to elevate myself too much, but I do plan on, I'm keeping close to her in my reporting. So.
Well, that is very important, and I'm glad you're doing it. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, so the show notes page is tomwoods.com/301. A couple things for you guys. I've told you about a new podcast that's coming in 2015 that will feature Bob Murphy and me, and we're going to refute the Paul Krugman New York Times column of the week and thereby teach economics. That's the point of it, is to spread knowledge, spread understanding. And every single week, we're going to dismantle the Krugman column. It's going to be a lot of fun, but it's probably not going to start until the spring of 2015. I have got to finish the course I'm currently doing for RonPaulHomeschool.com. I can't take anything else on without losing my mind completely, so that's when we're going to do it. But just last night, I was on a call with my friends who are doing the design of the site, because we're going to have a website for the show. And, of course, I'm using Studio One Design again because they did such a good job on tomwoods.com. So I called them up, and we talked about it. It's going to look great. And, of course, I will also be using WP Engine as a hosting company, because I am sick and tired of hosting companies that leave me with a 10-hour outage, and they just say, whoops, sorry. Sorry your site was down for 10 hours, or sorry it takes 10 hours for the site to load. So I'll be using WP Engine, as I use on tomwoods.com. And incidentally, they're having a deal going on right now. If you use them, which I recommend, I don't recommend using these other ones unless you absolutely have to, but WP Engine's having a deal, $25 off the first 3 months of hosting with code ARTOFBLOG, all one word, ARTOFBLOG in all caps. You can access them through tomwoods.com/engine and then type in ARTOFBLOG in all caps at checkout and save some dough. Also, forgive me for not doing this sooner, but I want to thank you guys for making possible the redesign of TomWoods.com so that we can have these nice show notes pages, that we can integrate the podcast into the site, that we don't have two sites anymore. It's all in a nice, neat, compact, professional-looking, very easy-to-use website. And you guys made that possible. You guys made it possible by being supporting listeners of the show, which you can find out about that on any of the show notes pages, or making your purchases through the Amazon widget that you'll find at TomWoods.com. You'll also find it on the show page, which is now where TomWoodsRadio.com redirects. We don't use that anymore. But if you type in TomWoodsRadio.com, it takes you right to TomWoods.com/podcast. And that's another place where the Amazon widget will be staring you right in the face. All this gave me a fund that I could draw from to do this. I mean, this was not cheap, but it needed to be done, and you guys helped me do it, and I'm really grateful for that. If all goes well, tomorrow we will be talking about how the West abolished slavery. It's a story we all think we know, maybe, but we know it very vaguely. How did it actually happen? It's an extraordinary phenomenon, the abolition of slavery. How did it happen throughout the West? That will be our topic for tomorrow, so make sure you've subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher so you don't miss a single episode of your daily serving of Liberty Education, The Tom Woods Show. You can subscribe easily at TomWoods.com. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.